only describe their little band, whichever it is, as the people. Everyone else is something different, something less than human. If this is our natural way of viewing the world, then it should occasion no surprise that every time we make a naive judgment about our place in the universe, one untempered by careful and skeptical scientific examination, we almost always opt for the centrality of our group and circumstance. We want to believe, moreover, that these are objective facts and not our prejudices finding a sanctioned vent. So it's not much fun to have a gaggle of scientists incessantly haranguing us with, "You're ordinary, you're unimportant, your privileges are undeserved, there's nothing special about you." Even unexcitable people might after a while grow annoyed at this incantation and those who insist on chanting it. It almost seems that the scientists are getting some weird satisfaction out of putting humans down. Why can't they find a way in which we're superior? Lift our spirits. Exalt us. In such debates, science, with its mantra of discouragement, feels cold and remote, dispassionate, detached, unresponsive to human needs. And again, if we're not important, not central, not the apple of God's eye, what is implied for our theologically based moral codes? The discovery of our true bearings in the cosmos was resisted for so long and to such a degree that many traces of the debate remain, sometimes with the motives of the geocentrists laid bare. I want to read a revealing, unsigned commentary, more or less typical, in the British review The Spectator in 1892. Quote, "It is certain enough that the discovery of the heliocentric motion of the planets, which reduced our Earth to its proper insignificance in the solar system, did a good deal to reduce to a similar but far from proper insignificance the moral principles by which the predominant races of the Earth had hitherto been guided and restrained. Part of this effort was no doubt due to the evidence afforded that the physical science of various inspired writers was erroneous instead of being infallible, a conviction which unduly shook the confidence felt even in their moral and religious teaching. But a good deal of it was due only to the mere sense of insignificance with which man has contemplated himself, since he has discovered that he inhabits nothing but a very obscure corner of the universe instead of the central world round which sun, moon, and stars alike revolved. There can be no doubt that man may feel himself, and has often felt himself, a great deal too insignificant to be the object of any particular divine training or care. If the earth be regarded as a sort of anthill, and the life and death of human beings as the life and death of so many ants, which run into and out of so many holes in search of food and sunlight, it is quite certain that no adequate importance will be attached to the duties of human life, and that a profound fatalism and hopelessness instead of new hopefulness will attach to human effort. For the present, at least, the review concludes, our horizons are quite vast enough till we can get used to the infinite horizons we already have and not lose our balance so much as we usually do in contemplating them. The yearning for still wider horizons is premature. So what do we really want from philosophy and religion? Palliatives? Therapy? Comfort? Do we want reassuring fables or an understanding of our actual circumstances? Dismay that the universe does not conform to our preferences seems childish. You might think that grown-ups would be ashamed to put such disappointments into print. The fashionable way of doing this is not to blame the universe, which seems truly pointless, but rather to blame the means by which we know the universe, namely science. George Bernard Shaw, in the preface to his play St. Joan, described a sense of science preying on our credulity, forcing on us an alien worldview, intimidating belief. Quote, In the Middle Ages, people believed that the earth was flat, for which they had at least the evidence of their senses. We believe it to be round not because as many as 1% of us could give the physical reason for so quaint a belief, but because modern science has convinced us that nothing that is obvious is true, and that everything that is magical, improbable, extraordinary, gigantic, microscopic, heartless, or outrageous is scientific. Close quote. A more recent and very instructive example is a book called Understanding the Present, Science and the Soul of Modern Man by Brian Appleyard, a British journalist. This book makes explicit what many people feel all over the world, but are too embarrassed to say. Appleyard's candor is refreshing. He is a true believer and will not let us slough over the contradictions between modern science and traditional religion. Science has taken away our religion, he laments. And what sort of religion is it that he longs for? One in which, quote, the human race was the point, the heart, the final cause of the whole system. It placed ourselves definitely upon the universal map. We were the end, the purpose, the rational axle around which the great Aetherian shells rotated. He longs for, quote, the universe of Catholic orthodoxy, in which, quote, the cosmos is shown to be a machine constructed around the drama of salvation, by which Appleyard means that despite explicit orders to the contrary, a woman and a man once ate of an apple, and that this act of insubordination transformed the universe into a contrivance for operant conditioning their remote descendants. By contrast, he says, modern science, quote, presents us as accidents. We are caused by the cosmos, but we are not the cause of it. Modern man is not finally anything. He has no role in creation, close quote. Science is, quote, spiritually corrosive, burning away ancient authorities and traditions. It cannot really coexist with anything. Science, quietly and inexplicitly, is talking us into abandoning ourselves, our true selves, close quote. It reveals, quote, the mute, alien spectacle of nature. Human beings cannot live with such a revelation. The only morality left is that of the consoling lie, close quote. Anything is better, he seems to be saying, than grappling with the unbearable burden of being tiny. In a passage reminiscent of Pius IX, Appleyard even decries the fact that, quote, a modern democracy can be expected to include a number of contradictory religious faiths, which are obliged to agree on a certain limited number of general injunctions, but no more. They must not burn each other's places of worship, but they may deny, even abuse each other's God. This is the effective scientific way of proceeding, close quote. But what is the alternative? Obdurately to pretend to certainty in an uncertain world? To adopt a comforting belief system, no matter how out of kilter with the facts it is? If we don't know what's real, how can we deal with reality? For practical reasons, we can't live too much in fantasy land. Shall we censor one another's religions and burn down one another's places of worship? How can we be sure which of the thousands of human belief systems should become unchallenged, ubiquitous, mandatory? These quotations betray a failure of nerve before the universe, its grandeur and magnificence, but especially its indifference. Science has taught us that because we have a talent for deceiving ourselves, subjectivity may not freely reign. This is one reason Appleyard so mistrusts science. It seems too reasoned, measured, and impersonal. Its conclusions derive from the interrogation of nature, and are not in all cases pre-designed to satisfy our wants. Appleyard deplores moderation. He yearns for inerrant doctrine, release from the exercise of judgment, and an obligation to believe, but not to question. He has not grasped human fallibility. He recognizes no need to institutionalize error-correcting machinery, either in our social institutions or in our view of the universe. This is the anguished cry of the infant when the parent does not come. But most people eventually come to grips with reality and with the painful absence of parents who will absolutely guarantee that no harm befalls the little ones so long as they do what they're told. Eventually, most people find ways to accommodate to the universe, especially when given the tools to think straight. All that we pass on to our children in the scientific age, Appleyard complains, quote, is the conviction that nothing is true, final, or enduring, including the culture from which they sprang, close quote. How right he is about the inadequacy of our legacy. But would it be enriched by adding baseless certainties? He scorns, quote, the pious hope that science and religion are independent realms which can easily be separated, close quote. Instead, he says, quote, science, as it is now, is absolutely not compatible with religion, close quote. But isn't Appleyard really saying that some religions now find it difficult to make unchallenged pronouncements on the nature of the world that are straight out false? We recognize that even revered religious leaders, the products of their time, as we are of ours, may have made mistakes. Religions contradict one another on small matters such as whether we should put on a hat or take one off on entering a house of worship, or whether we should eat beef and eschew pork or the other way around, all the way to the most central issues such as whether there are no gods, one god, or many gods. Science has brought many of us to that state in which Nathaniel Hawthorne found Herman Melville. He can neither believe, Hawthorne said, nor be comfortable in his unbelief. Or Jean-Jacques Rousseau, quote, they had not persuaded me, but they had troubled me. Their arguments had shaken me without ever convincing me. It is hard to prevent oneself from believing what one so keenly desires, close quote. As the belief systems taught by the secular and religious authorities are undermined, respect for authority in general probably does erode. The lesson is clear. Even political leaders must be wary of embracing false doctrine. This is not a failing of science, but one of its graces. Of course, worldview consensus is comforting, while clashes of opinion may be unsettling and demand more of us. But unless we insist against all evidence that our ancestors were perfect, the advance of knowledge requires us to unravel and then restitch the consensus they established. In some respects, science has far surpassed religion in delivering awe. How is it that hardly any major religion has looked at science and concluded, this is better than we thought. The universe is much bigger than our prophets said, grander, more subtle, more elegant. God must be even greater than we dreamed. Instead, they say, no, 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 my God is a little God, and I want him to stay that way. A religion old or new that stressed the magnificence of the universe as revealed by modern science might be able to draw forth reserves of reverence and awe hardly tapped by the conventional faiths. Sooner or later, such a religion will emerge. If you lived 2 or 3 millennia ago, there was no shame in holding that the universe was made for us. It was an appealing thesis consistent with everything we knew. It was what the most learned among us taught without qualification. But we found out much since then. Defending such a position today amounts to willful disregard of the evidence and a flight from self-knowledge. Still, for many of us, these deprovincializations rankle. Even if they do not fully carry the day, they erode confidence. unlike the happy anthropocentric certitudes, rippling with social utility, of an earlier age. We long to be here for a purpose, even though, despite much self-deception, none is evident. The meaningless absurdity of life, wrote Leo Tolstoy, is the only incontestable knowledge accessible to man. Close quote. Our time is burdened under the cumulative weight of successive debunkings of our conceits. We're Johnny-come-latelys. We live in the cosmic boondocks. We emerged from microbes and muck. Apes are our cousins. Our thoughts and feelings are not fully under our own control. There may be much smarter and very different beings elsewhere. And on top of all this, we're making a mess of our planet and becoming a danger to ourselves. The trapdoor beneath our feet swings open. We find ourselves in bottomless freefall. We are lost in a great darkness, and there's no one to send out a search party. Given so harsh a reality, of course we're tempted to shut our eyes and pretend that we're safe and snug at home, that the fall is only a bad dream. We lack consensus about our place in the universe. There is no generally agreed upon long-term vision of the goal of our species, other than, perhaps, simple survival. Especially when times are hard, we become desperate for encouragement, unreceptive to the litany of great emotions and dashed hopes, and much more willing to hear that we're special, never mind if the evidence is paper thin. If it takes a little myth and ritual to get us through a night that seems endless, who among us cannot sympathize and understand? But if our objective is deep knowledge rather than shallow reassurance, the gains from this new perspective far outweigh the losses. Once we overcome our fear of being tiny, we find ourselves on the threshold of a vast and awesome universe that utterly dwarfs in time, in space, and in potential the tidy anthropocentric proscenium of our ancestors. We gaze across billions of light years of space to view the universe shortly after the Big Bang and plumb the fine structure of matter. We peer down into the core of our planet and the blazing interior of our star. We read the genetic language in which is written the diverse skills and propensities of every being on Earth. We uncover hidden chapters in the record of our own origins, and with some anguish, better understand our nature and prospects. We invent and refine agriculture, without which almost all of us would starve to death. We create medicines and vaccines that save the lives of billions. We communicate at the speed of light and whip around the Earth in an hour and a half. We have sent dozens of ships to more than 70 worlds and 4 spacecraft to the stars. We are right to rejoice in our accomplishments, to be proud that our species has been able to see so far, and to judge our merit, in part, by the very science that has so deflated our pretensions. To our ancestors, there was much in nature to be afraid of. Lightning, storms, earthquakes, volcanoes, plagues, drought, long winters. Religions arose in part as attempts to propitiate and control, if not much to understand, the disorderly aspect of nature. The scientific revolution permitted us to glimpse an underlying, ordered universe in which there was a literal harmony of the worlds. That's Johannes Kepler's phrase. If we understand nature, there is a prospect of controlling it, or at least mitigating the harm it may bring. In this sense, science brought hope. Most of the great deprovincializing debates were entered into with no thought for their practical implications. Passionate and curious humans wished to understand their actual circumstances, how unique or pedestrian they in their world are, their ultimate origins and destinies, how the universe works. Surprisingly, some of these debates have yielded the most profound practical benefits. The very method of mathematical reasoning that Isaac Newton introduced to explain the motion of the planets around the sun has led to most of the technology of our modern world. The Industrial Revolution, for all its shortcomings, is still the global model of how an agricultural nation can emerge from poverty. These debates have bread and butter consequences. It might have been otherwise. It might have been that the balance lay elsewhere, that humans by and large did not want to know about a disquieting universe, that we were unwilling to permit challenges to the prevailing wisdom. Despite determined resistance in every age, it is very much to our credit that we have allowed ourselves to follow the evidence, to draw conclusions that at first seemed daunting. A universe so much larger and older that our personal and historical experience is dwarfed and humbled. A universe in which every day suns are born and worlds obliterated. A universe in which humanity, newly arrived, clings to an obscure clod of matter. How much more satisfying had we been placed in a garden custom made for us, its other occupants put there for us to use as we saw fit. There is a celebrated story in the Western tradition like this, except that not quite everything was there for us. There was one particular tree of which we were not to partake, a tree of knowledge. Knowledge and understanding and wisdom were forbidden to us in this story. We were to be kept ignorant. But we couldn't help ourselves. We were starving for knowledge. Created hungry, you might say. This was the origin of all our troubles. In particular, it's why we no longer live in a garden. We found out too much. So long as we were incurious and obedient, I imagine, we could console ourselves with our importance and centrality and tell ourselves that we were the reason the universe was made. As we began to indulge our curiosity, though, to explore, to learn how the universe really is, we expelled ourselves from Eden. Angels with a flaming sword were set as sentries at the gates of paradise to bar our return. The gardeners became exiles and wanderers. Occasionally, we mourn that lost world, but that, it seems to me, is maudlin and sentimental. We could not happily have remained ignorant forever. There is in this universe much of what seems to be design. Every time we come upon it, we breathe a sigh of relief. We're forever hoping to find, or at least to safely deduce, a designer. But instead, we repeatedly discover that natural processes, collisional selection of worlds, say, or natural selection of gene pools, or even the convection pattern in a pot of boiling water, can extract order out of chaos and deceive us into deducing purpose where there is none. In everyday life, we often sense, in the bedrooms of teenagers or in national politics, that chaos is natural and order imposed from above. While there are deeper regularities in the universe than the simple circumstances we generally describe as orderly, all that order, simple and complex, seems to derive from laws of nature established at the Big Bang, or maybe earlier, rather than as a consequence of belated intervention by an imperfect deity. God is to be found in the details, is the famous dictum of the German scholar Abby Warburg. But amid much elegance and precision, the details of life in the universe also exhibit haphazard, jury-rigged arrangements, and much poor planning. What shall we make of this? An edifice abandoned early in construction by the architect? The evidence so far at least, and laws of nature aside, does not require a designer. Maybe there's one hiding, maddeningly unwilling to be revealed. Sometimes it seems a very slender hope. The significance of our lives and our fragile planet is then determined only by our own wisdom and courage. We are the custodians of life's meaning. We long for a parent to care for us, to forgive us our errors, to save us from our childish mistakes. But knowledge is preferable to ignorance. Better by far to embrace the hard truth than a reassuring fable. If we crave some cosmic purpose, then let us find ourselves a worthy goal.
Chapter 5. Is there intelligent life on Earth? They journeyed a long time and found nothing. At length, they discerned a small light, which was the Earth. But they could not find the smallest reason to suspect that we and our fellow citizens of this globe have the honor to exist. Voltaire, Micromegas, A Philosophical History, 1752. There are places in and around our great cities where the natural world has all but disappeared. You can make out streets and sidewalks, autos, parking garages, advertising billboards, monuments of glass and steel, but not a tree or a blade of grass or any animal, besides, of course, the humans. There are lots of humans. Only when you look straight up through the skyscraper canyons can you make out a star or a patch of blue, reminders of what was there long before humans came to be. But the bright lights of the big cities bleach out the stars, and even that patch of blue is sometimes gone, tinted brown by industrial technology. It's not hard going to work every day in such a place to be impressed with ourselves, how we've transformed the Earth for our benefit and convenience. But a few hundred miles up or down, there are no humans. Apart from a thin film of life at the very surface of the Earth, an occasional intrepid spacecraft, and some radio static, our impact on the universe is nil. It knows nothing of us. You're an alien explorer entering the solar system after a long journey through the blackness of interstellar space. You examine the planets of this humdrum star from afar. A pretty handful. Some gray, some blue, some red, some yellow. You're interested in what kinds of worlds these are, whether their environments are static or changing, and especially whether there are life and intelligence. You have no prior knowledge of the Earth. You've just discovered its existence. There's a galactic ethic, let's imagine. Look, but don't touch. You can fly by these worlds, you can orbit them, but you are strictly forbidden to land. Under such constraints, could you figure out what the Earth's environment is like and whether anyone lives there? As you approach, your first impression of the whole Earth is white clouds, white polar caps, brown continents, and some bluish substance that covers two-thirds of the surface. When you take the temperature of this world from the infrared radiation it emits, you find that most latitudes are above the freezing point of water, while the polar caps are below freezing. Water is a very abundant material in the universe. Polar caps made of solid water would be a reasonable guess, as well as clouds of solid and liquid water. You might also be tempted by the idea that the blue stuff is enormous quantities, kilometers deep, of liquid water. The suggestion is bizarre, though, at least as far as this solar system is concerned, because surface oceans of liquid water exist nowhere else. When you look in the visible and near-infrared spectrum for telltale signatures of chemical composition, sure enough, you discover water ice in the polar caps, and enough water vapor in the air to account for the clouds. This is also just the right amount that must exist because of evaporation if the oceans are in fact made of liquid water. the bizarre hypothesis is confirmed. The spectrometers further reveal that the air on this world is 1/5 oxygen, O2. No other planet in the solar system has anything close to so much oxygen. Where does it all come from? The intense ultraviolet light from the sun breaks water, H2O, down into oxygen and hydrogen, and hydrogen, the lightest gas, quickly escapes to space. This is a source of O2, certainly, but it doesn't easily account for so much oxygen. Another possibility is that ordinary visible light, which the sun pours out in vast amounts, is used on Earth to break water apart, except that there's no known way to do this without life. There would have to be plants, life forms colored by a pigment that strongly absorbs visible light, that knows how to split a water molecule by saving up the energy of 2 photons of light, that retains the H and excretes the O, and that uses the hydrogen thus liberated to synthesize organic molecules. The plants would have to be spread over much of the planet. All this is asking a lot. If you're a good skeptical scientist, so much O2 would not be proof of life. But it certainly might be cause for suspicion. With all that oxygen, you're not surprised to discover ozone, O3, in the atmosphere, because ultraviolet light makes ozone out of molecular oxygen, O2. The ozone then absorbs dangerous ultraviolet radiation. So if the oxygen is due to life, there's a curious sense in which the life is protecting itself. But this life might be mere photosynthetic plants. A high level of intelligence is not implied. When you examine the continents more closely, you find there are, crudely speaking, 2 kinds of regions. One shows the spectrum of ordinary rocks and minerals as found on many worlds. The other reveals something unusual, a material covering vast areas that strongly absorbs red light. The sun, of course, shines in light of all colors, with a peak in the yellow. This pigment might be just the agent needed if ordinary visible light is being used to break water apart and account for the oxygen in the air. It's another hint, this time a little stronger, of life. Not a bug here and there, but a planetary surface overflowing with life. The pigment is in fact chlorophyll. It absorbs blue light as well as red, and is responsible for the fact that plants are green. What you're seeing is a densely vegetated planet. So the Earth is revealed to possess 3 properties unique at least in this solar system. Oceans, oxygen, life. It's hard not to think they're related. The oceans being the sites of origin, and the oxygen the product of abundant life. When you look carefully at the infrared spectrum of the Earth, you discover the minor constituents of the air. In addition to water vapor, there's carbon dioxide, CO2, methane, CH4, and other gases that absorb the heat that the Earth tries to radiate away to space at night. These gases warm the planet. Without them, the Earth would everywhere be below the freezing point of water. You've discovered this world's greenhouse effect. Methane and oxygen together in the same atmosphere is peculiar. The laws of chemistry are very clear. In an excess of O2, CH4 should be entirely converted into H2O and CO2. The process is so efficient that not a single molecule in all the Earth's atmosphere should be methane. Instead, you find that 1 out of every 1,000,000 molecules is methane. An immense discrepancy. What could it mean? The only possible explanation is that methane is being injected into the Earth's atmosphere so quickly that its chemical reaction with O2 can't keep pace. Where does all this methane come from? Maybe it seeps out of the deep interior of the Earth. But quantitatively, this doesn't seem to work. And Mars and Venus don't have anything like this much methane. The only alternatives are biological, a conclusion that makes no assumptions about the chemistry of life or what it looks like, but follows merely from how unstable methane is in an oxygen atmosphere. In fact, the methane arises from such sources as bacteria in bogs, the cultivation of rice, the burning of vegetation, natural gas from oil wells, and bovine flatulence. In an oxygen atmosphere, methane is a sign of life. That the intimate intestinal activities of cows should be detectable from interplanetary space is a little disconcerting, especially when so much of what we hold dear is not. But an alien scientist flying by the Earth would at this point be unable to deduce bogs, rice, fire, oil, or cows. Just life. All the signs of life that we've discussed so far are due to comparatively simple forms. The methane in the rumens of cows is generated by bacteria that homestead there. Had your spacecraft flown by the Earth 100 million years ago, in the age of the dinosaurs, when there were no humans and no technology, you would still have seen oxygen and ozone, the chlorophyll pigment, and far too much methane. At present, though, your instruments are finding signs not just of life, but of high technology, something that couldn't possibly have been detected even 100 years ago. You are detecting a particular kind of radio wave emanating from Earth. Radio waves don't necessarily signify life and intelligence. Many natural processes generate them. You've already found radio emissions from other apparently uninhabited worlds, generated by electrons trapped in the strong magnetic fields of planets, by chaotic motions at the shock front that separates these magnetic fields from the interplanetary magnetic field, and by lightning. Radio whistlers usually sweep from high notes to low and then begin again. Some of these radio emissions are continuous. Some come in repetitive bursts. Some last a few minutes and then disappear. But this is different. A portion of the radio transmission from Earth is at just the frequencies where radio waves begin to leak out of the planet's ionosphere, the electrically charged region above the stratosphere that reflects and absorbs radio waves. There is a constant central frequency for each transmission, added to which is a modulated signal, a complex sequence of ons and offs. No electrons in magnetic fields, no shock waves, no lightning discharges can generate something like this. Intelligent life seems to be the only possible explanation. Your conclusion that the radio transmission is due to technology on Earth holds no matter what the ons and offs mean. You don't have to decode the message to be sure it is a message. This signal is really, let us suppose, communications from the U.S. Navy to its distant nuclear-armed submarines. So as an alien explorer, you would know that at least one species on Earth has achieved radio technology. Which one is it? The beings that make methane? Those that generate oxygen? The ones whose pigment colors the landscape green? Or somebody else? Somebody more subtle? Someone not otherwise detectable to a spacecraft plummeting by? To search for this technological species, you might want to examine the Earth at finer and finer resolution, seeking, if not the beings themselves, at least their artifacts. You look first with a modest telescope, so the finest detail you can resolve is 1 or 2 kilometers across. You can make out no monumental architecture, no strange formations, no unnatural reworking of the landscape, no signs of life. You see a dense atmosphere in motion. The abundant water must evaporate and then rain back down. Ancient impact craters, apparent on the Earth's nearby moon, are almost wholly absent. There must, then, be a set of processes whereby new land is created and then eroded away in much less time than the age of this world. Running water is implicated. As you look with finer and finer definition, you find mountain ranges, river valleys, and many other indications that the planet is geologically active. There are also odd places surrounded by vegetation, but which are themselves denuded of plants. They look like discolored smudges on the landscape. When you examine the Earth at about 100-meter resolution, everything changes. The planet is revealed to be covered with straight lines, squares, rectangles, circles, sometimes huddling along riverbanks or nestling on the lower slopes of mountains, sometimes stretching over plains, but rarely in deserts or high mountains, and absolutely never in the oceans. Their regularity, complexity, and distribution would be hard to explain except by life and intelligence, although a deeper understanding of function and purpose might be elusive. Perhaps you would conclude only that the dominant life forms have a simultaneous passion for territoriality and Euclidean geometry. At this resolution, you could not see them, much less know them. Many of the devegetated smudges are revealed to have an underlying checkerboard geometry. These are the planet's cities. Over much of the landscape, and not just in the cities, there is a profusion of straight lines, squares, rectangles, circles. The dark smudges of the cities are revealed to be highly geometrized, with only a few patches of vegetation, themselves with highly regular boundaries, left intact. There are occasional triangles, and in one city, there is even a pentagon. When you take pictures at a meter resolution or better, you find that the crisscrossing straight lines within the cities and the long straight lines that join them with other cities are filled with streamlined, multicolored beings a few meters in length, politely running one behind the other in long, slow, orderly procession. They are very patient. One stream of beings stops so another stream can continue at right angles. Periodically, the favor is returned. At night, they turn on two bright lights in front so they can see where they're going. Some, a privileged few, go into little houses when their workday is done and retire for the night. Most are homeless and sleep on the streets. At last, you've detected the source of all the technology, the dominant life forms on the planet. The streets of the cities and the roadways of the countryside are evidently built for their benefit. You might believe that you're really beginning to understand life on Earth. And perhaps you'd be right. If the resolution improved just a little further, you'd discover tiny parasites that occasionally enter and exit the dominant organisms. They play some deeper role, though, because the stationary dominant organism will often start up again just after it's reinfected by a parasite and stop again just before the parasite is expelled. This is puzzling, but no one said life on Earth would be easy to understand. All the images you've taken so far are in reflected sunlight, that is, on the day side of the planet. Something most interesting is revealed when you photograph the Earth at night. The planet is lit up. The brightest region near the Arctic Circle is illuminated by the aurora borealis, generated not by life, but by electrons and protons from the sun beamed down by the Earth's magnetic field. Everything else you see is due to life. The lights recognizably outline the same continents you can make out in daytime, and many correspond to cities you've already mapped. The cities are concentrated near coastlines. They tend to be sparser in continental interiors. Perhaps the dominant organisms are desperate for seawater, or maybe ocean-going ships were once essential for commerce and emigration. Some of the lights, though, are not due to cities. In North Africa, the Middle East, and Siberia, for example, there are very bright lights in a comparatively barren landscape, due, it turns out, to burn-off in oil and natural gas wells. In the Sea of Japan, on the day you first look, there is a strange triangular-shaped area of light. In daytime, it corresponds to open ocean. This is no city. What could it be? It is, in fact, the Japanese squid fishing fleet using brilliant illumination to attract schools of squid up to their depths. On other days, this pattern of light wanders all over the Pacific Ocean, seeking prey. In effect, what you have discovered here is sushi. It seems sobering to me that from space you can so readily detect some of the odds and ends of life on Earth. The gastrointestinal habits of ruminants, Japanese cuisine, the means of communicating with nomadic submarines that carried death for 200 cities, while so much of our monumental architecture, our greatest engineering works, our efforts to care for one another, are almost wholly invisible. It's a kind of parable. By this point, your expedition to the Earth must be considered highly successful. You've characterized the environment, you've detected life, you've found manifestations of intelligent beings, you may even have identified the dominant species, the one transfixed with geometry and rectilinearity. Surely this planet is worth a longer and more detailed study. That's why you've now inserted your spacecraft into orbit around the Earth. Looking down on the planet, you uncover new puzzles. All over the Earth, smokestacks are pouring carbon dioxide and toxic chemicals into the air. So are the dominant beings who run on the roadways. But carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. As you watch, the amount of it in the atmosphere increases steadily year after year. The same is true of methane and other greenhouse gases. If this keeps up, the temperature of the planet is going to increase. Spectroscopically, you discover another class of molecules being injected into the air, the chlorofluorocarbons. Not only are they greenhouse gases, but they are also devastatingly effective in destroying the protective ozone layer. You look more closely at the center of the South American continent, which, as you know by now, is a vast rainforest. Every night, you see thousands of fires. In the daytime, you find the region covered with smoke. Over the years, all over the planet, you find less and less forest and more scrub desert. You look down on the large island of Madagascar. The rivers are colored brown, generating a vast stain in the surrounding ocean. This is topsoil being washed out to sea at a rate so high that in another few decades, there will be none left. The same thing is happening, you note, at the mouths of rivers all over the planet. But no topsoil means no agriculture. In another century, what will they eat? What will they breathe? How will they cope with a changing and more dangerous environment? From your orbital perspective, you can see that something has unmistakably gone wrong. The dominant organisms, whoever they are, who have gone to so much trouble to rework the surface, are simultaneously destroying their ozone layer and their forests, eroding their topsoil, and performing massive, uncontrolled experiments on their planet's climate. Haven't they noticed what's happening? Are they oblivious to their fate? Are they unable to work together on behalf of the environment that sustains them all? Perhaps you think it's time to reassess the conjecture that there's intelligent life on Earth. Looking for life elsewhere, a calibration. Spacecraft from the Earth have now flown by dozens of planets, moons, comets, and asteroids, equipped with cameras, instruments for measuring heat and radio waves, spectrometers to determine composition, and a host of other devices. We have found not a hint of life anywhere else in the solar system. But you might be skeptical about our ability to detect life elsewhere, especially life different from the kind we know. Until recently, we had never performed the obvious calibration test. To fly a modern interplanetary spacecraft by the Earth and see whether we could detect ourselves. This all changed on December 8, 1990. Galileo is a NASA spacecraft designed to explore the giant planet Jupiter, its moons, and its rings. It's named after the heroic Italian scientist who played so central a role in toppling the geocentric pretension. It is he who first saw Jupiter as a world and who discovered its four big moons. To get to Jupiter, the spacecraft had to fly close by Venus once, and the Earth twice, and be accelerated by the gravities of these planets. Otherwise, there wasn't enough oomph to get it where it was going. This necessity of trajectory design permitted us for the first time to look systematically at the Earth from an alien perspective. Galileo passed only 960 kilometers, about 600 miles, above the Earth's surface, with some exceptions, including pictures showing features finer than 1 kilometer across and the images of the Earth at night. Much of the spacecraft data described in this chapter were actually obtained by Galileo. With Galileo, we were able to deduce an oxygen atmosphere, water, clouds, oceans, polar ice, life, and intelligence. The use of instruments and protocols developed to explore the planets to monitor the environmental health of our own, something NASA is now doing in earnest, was described by the astronaut Sally Ride as Mission to Planet Earth. Other members of the NASA scientific team who worked with me on Galileo's detection of life on Earth were Drs. W. Reed Thompson, Cornell University, Robert Carlson, JPL, Donald Gurnett, University of Iowa, and Charles Hoard, University of Colorado. Our success in detecting life on Earth with Galileo, without making any assumptions beforehand about what kind of life it must be, increases our confidence that when we fail to find life on other planets, that negative result is meaningful. Is this judgment anthropocentric, geocentric, provincial? I don't think so. We're not looking only for our kind of biology. Any widespread photosynthetic pigment, any gas grossly out of equilibrium with the rest of the atmosphere, any rendering of the surface into highly geometrized patterns, any steady constellation of lights on the night hemisphere, any non-astrophysical sources of radio emission would betoken the presence of life. On Earth, we have found, of course, only our type, but many other types would have been detectable elsewhere. We have not found them. This examination of the third planet strengthens our tentative conclusion that of all the worlds in the solar system, only ours is graced by life. We have just begun to search. Maybe life is hiding on Mars or Jupiter, Europa or Titan. Maybe the galaxy is filled with worlds as rich in life as ours. Maybe we are on the verge of making such discoveries. But in terms of actual knowledge, at this moment, the Earth is unique. No other world is yet known to harbor even a microbe, much less a technical civilization. Chapter 6, The Triumph of Voyager. They that go down to the sea in ships, that do business in great waters, these see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. Psalms 107, circa 150 BC. The visions we offer our children shape the future. It matters what those visions are. Often they become self-fulfilling prophecies. Dreams are maps. I do not think it irresponsible to portray even the direst futures if we are to avoid them. We must understand that they are possible. But where are the alternatives? Where are the dreams that motivate and inspire? We long for realistic maps of a world we can be proud to give to our children. Where are the cartographers of human purpose? Where are the visions of hopeful futures, of technology as a tool for human betterment, and not a gun on hair trigger pointed at our heads? NASA, in its ordinary course of doing business, offers such a vision. But in the late 1980s and early 90s, many people saw the U.S. space program as instead a succession of catastrophes. 7 brave Americans killed on a mission whose main function was to put up a communication satellite that could have been launched at less cost without risking anybody. A $1 billion telescope sent up with a bad case of myopia. A spacecraft to Jupiter whose main antenna, essential for returning data to Earth, did not unfurl. A probe lost just as it was about to orbit Mars. Some people cringe every time NASA describes as exploration sending a few astronauts 200 miles up in a small capsule that endlessly circles the Earth and goes nowhere. Compared to the brilliant achievements of robotic missions, it is striking how rarely fundamental scientific findings emerge from manned missions. Except for repairing ineptly manufactured or malfunctioning satellites, or launching a satellite that could just as well have been sent up in an unmanned booster, the manned program has, since the 1970s, seemed unable to generate accomplishments commensurate with the cost. Others looked at NASA as a stalking horse for grandiose schemes to put weapons into space, despite the fact that an orbiting weapon is in many circumstances a sitting duck. And NASA showed many symptoms of an aging, arteriosclerotic, overcautious, unadventurous bureaucracy. The trend is perhaps beginning to be reversed. But these criticisms, many of them surely valid, should not blind us to NASA triumphs in the same period. The first exploration of the Uranus and Neptune systems, the in-orbit repair of the Hubble Space Telescope, the proof that the existence of galaxies is compatible with the Big Bang, the first close-up observations of asteroids, mapping Venus pole to pole, monitoring ozone depletion, demonstrating the existence of a black hole with the mass of 1 billion suns at the center of a nearby galaxy, and a historic commitment to joint space endeavors by the U.S. and Russia. There are far-reaching, visionary, and even revolutionary implications to the space program. Communication satellites link up the planet, are central to the global economy, and through television routinely convey the essential fact that we live in a global community. Meteorological satellites predict the weather, save lives in hurricanes and tornadoes, and avoid many billions of dollars in crop losses every year. Military reconnaissance and treaty verification satellites make nations and the global civilization more secure. In a world with tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, they calm the hotheads and paranoids on all sides. They are essential tools for survival on a troubled and unpredictable planet. Earth-observing satellites, especially a new generation soon to be deployed, monitor the health of the global environment. Greenhouse warming, topsoil erosion, ozone layer depletion, ocean currents, acid rain, the effects of floods and droughts, and new dangers we haven't yet discovered. This is straightforward planetary hygiene. Global positioning systems are now in place so that your locale is radio triangulated by several satellites. Holding a small instrument the size of a modern shortwave radio, you can read out to high precision your latitude and longitude. No crashed airplane, no ship in fog and shoals, no driver in an unfamiliar city need ever be lost again. Astronomical satellites, peering outward from Earth's orbit, observe with